Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Board Game Barbecue Podcast. This is episode 263, brought to you by Advent Games and our wonderful Patreons. I am Def. I'm going to be your host today. And with me in the co-host, co-pilot seat, I have Lauren. How are you doing, Lauren?
Yeah, good, Def. How's it going?
I'm all right. It only feels like we recorded that Patreon episode yesterday with you.
Yeah, just can't get rid of me, Def.
Oh well, we're gonna have to make do with what we've got. I'm so excited to have you with me to record today, Lauren, and we have a very special guest with us today, Scott Pease. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing great, thanks.
So Scott is the developer behind a new game that's been released recently, Snapships Tactics, and as far as I know, Scott, you've got a rich background from the video game development industry as well. So do you want to tell us a few things about yourself and how you ended up in the tabletop board game space?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a lifelong gamer. I grew up playing a mix of board games and video games. And then when I graduated from college, I went straight into the video game industry and eventually ended up at a little developer called Neversoft, which was a studio that was owned by Activision, and we made a whole bunch of games. We did, I think over my time there, we did something like 17 different games across all the different platforms, mainly the Tony Hawk's Pro Skater series. That was my baby for 9 years. And then we moved on to Guitar Hero and took that over and made 7 Guitar Hero games, and then ended up with 1 Call of Duty game, and that one kind of did me in. I was done with video games after. And I kind of always had a lifelong love for toys and games. And after retirement, got bored pretty quickly and started tinkering around with some board game and toy ideas. And along with my good friend from video games, Jeff Swente, we developed this concept called Snapship. And Snapship started out as, you know, the original conception of it was a constructible spaceship board game. But that was a whole lot to take on from the get-go. So we decided to kind of break it up into 2 chunks and work on first the toy system of building these modular spaceships out of plastic parts. And then figured at some point down the road, we'd be able to revisit the board game concept and kind of bring it all together. So Snapships began life as a toy line here in the United States. And I think actually some of the kits reached Australia in the last few years. And that was a toy line published by a company called Play Monster.
Yeah, that's very exciting. And I guess what I wanted to ask you is, you know, through this process, did that idea come to you from playing other miniature tabletop games before, or was it something you always wanted to do? I guess what I'm trying to gauge here is where did you come up with the idea for modular spaceships? Was it coming more from the toy factor side of things, or was it coming more from somewhere in the design process about how it can evolve in the future?
Yeah, I think it really was from the toy factor. That was, I don't know, it was just an idea that was always stuck in my brain that I thought could work digitally or physically. But after working in video games and doing so many of these sort of, we call them create-a modes, right? Like create a character or create a skate park or create a song, like all these sort of user creation digital tools, I kind of wanted to take on the challenge of making something physical and seeing if I could make that work. Now, I was being totally naive at the time, because making a system like that work physically is a whole different ball game with all kinds of different limitations and all kinds of new stuff that we had to learn.
So what were some of the challenges that you encountered? Because obviously there's a lot of freedom with what you can do and how you can design and create in a digital space versus a physical space.
Yeah, well, it's dealing with all that materiality, right? Like, this is how naive we were. When we first made the prototypes of Snapships, and we just 3D printed everything on our home 3D printers to kind of work out how the system would work, how blocks would connect together and all that. We actually put magnets in them. So the first version of Snapships, each cube had something like 6 little magnets that were glued into it, and the cubes would snap together in a real satisfying way. But of course, as soon as we took that to some toy consultants, they were just like, you guys are insane. You're going to A, kill children and pets with your magnets, and B, it'll be way too expensive for that ever to reach market. So we kind of had to go back to the drawing board, and that's where we came up with the connection system that's in the models today, which is a dual material system. There's like a softer plastic on the inside core of the cubes, and then a harder shell that sits around that. And that allows these sort of peg and socket connection to be both really strong so that the models hold up, because of course they're like, you know, built out of all these modules and you can't have them falling apart. And also for there not to be like a hard plastic on hard plastic connection that can kind of wear out, which is a problem you see with a lot of, you know, toys and miniatures where connections wear out over time and they get loose and janky, and we didn't want that either.
Yeah, I was pretty impressed with the way, you know, it felt when assembling some of these ships. So I played the game a few days ago a few times, and, you know, I thought the initial build of the spaceships would be almost like a procedural thing, you know, like something you do to get to the game. And I discovered I enjoyed the process quite a lot. And I think part of it is because of this material combination that you guys used, because that meant that you could put the pieces together and take them out and, you know, do different configurations without feeling that you're damaging or you're somehow messing with the material. But you know how some of these other plastic bits that exist out there, either in miniatures or other things that you assemble, sometimes when you undo a thing you have pieced together, then it feels like, oh, this shouldn't have happened. And maybe when you put it back together a second time, it doesn't feel as strong as the first time. And so I was quite impressed with the material and the way that felt when putting together these ships.
Yeah, I mean, we worked a long time to try to perfect that. And the idea really is so that you can, I mean, we want you to build and rebuild and rebuild and be creative. And, you know, we give you in the box, we give you detailed instructions to build a you know, several different versions of each ship. But again, that's just to kind of get your brain going and thinking about how all these pieces can go together. And we really do want you to kind of create your own unique ship, your own custom looking miniature, so that when you bring your ship to the battlefield, it's going to be different from anyone else's that's out there.
Mm. So there's obviously a lot of tabletop miniature skirmish and war games out there. What are the parts of that kind of genre that you felt were lacking that you were trying to fill with Snapships?
I mean, it's all that customization, right? Like the idea was, again, make sure that you can build a miniature that sort of expresses, you know, what you want your ship to be like. And then the challenge was, well, then it needs to play uniquely as well. So that's where we worked with some really talented designers to come up with the whole system for the way in which you first build your ship physically and then collect all the cards that match up with the equipment that you put on your ship. And all those cards kind of create a control panel for your ship, which gives it unique actions. And a whole little, I don't know, almost like a, I guess, like almost like a Euro game economy that you're manipulating with your ship. And your ship is going to play differently than someone else's ship who has different parts on their ship, and they built their ship to do something completely differently.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I thought the action economy, if you want to call it that, so each ship has a starting set of cubes, blue cubes that are the action cubes. So you've got like 5, 6, 7 cubes. And then there's a bunch of heat cubes on the side that you bring in. And all those parts cards, they have a requirement to take these actions. So if you want to turn, or if you want to move your ship, or if you want to attack or ship a missile or whatever, then you have to spend some number of blue cubes. And in some cases, you have to bring in some heat as well, which you bring from a stockpile. And at the start of each of your turns, you can vent some of these cubes, I think the game calls it. So you can basically clear out a specific number of these cubes. And I found the decision space at that point was very interesting, because you can't, you can use all of your cubes, but then some of the cards are going to still be occupied next round, so you can't use them. And I thought the whole action economy, I guess, system was very good, very satisfying. And I think, is it fair to say that, you know, this will evolve into a series where customization is the main thing that drives the future expansions and more content for the game? Because it seems to me that even with a base series of ships, you can still do a truckload of things with them using the system, with, you know, without producing a whole new concept of a ship. You just have new parts that, you know, have a bunch of cards and then small pieces that attach to the ships and give you a different gameplay experience, which was what I saw in my first couple of games as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That's completely the goal of the game, is to continue to expand your palette of options and give you new unique parts with new abilities and new actions that you're going to have to decide, you know, how to bring those into your ships. And if you want to, you know, build a ship that has sort of a, what I call a purpose, you can make purpose-built ships. And this comes into play with the game, because again, the game, the starter box is like a 1v1 experience, but the game really starts to shine when you bring squads of ships to the battlefield and you're playing 2v2 ships or even 3v3, because then not only can you customize your ship, but you can give your ship specific purposes on the battlefield. So you might have a ship that's heavily armored and not very maneuverable, but its job is to get out and draw fire while your other two ships hang back and play a little stealthy sniping game and try to take out the enemy from afar. So there's just a whole host of different strategies that you can discover as you're sort of mixing and matching these parts and building and rebuilding your ships. And that's really the goal of the whole system. It's meant to be a foundation that we can then expand upon and add new abilities and new ships and more parts and just keep going with.
I've not had the chance to play Snapship Tactics yet, but I have played a bunch of X-Wing. And I like what you said, Scott, about the idea of the different units having more personality and flavor. I felt that that's something that was maybe a little bit lacking in X-Wing for me, wherein the X-Wing didn't feel too different to the A-Wing or the B-Wing. They just felt really kind of quite similar. And I wasn't able to inject as much personality into my individual units. There was still a lot of dynamic play if you have a large fleet, but it was kind of lacking a bit of that flavor, a bit of that personality.
Yeah, I think that's one place where we definitely differ from X-Wing. In X-Wing, your personality is more the squadron of ships that you bring to the table, and you've got a whole bunch of ships that are sort of flying around and doing things. In Snapships, we're focusing on one or two or maybe three ships to a side, but each one of those ships is its own little, almost its own little game that you're playing, its own little engine of power, inventing and parts and abilities. And so we're trying to kind of go deeper on each ship rather than wider and just have, you know, more and more units on the battlefield.
Looking at, you know, the toy factor of this game, Scott, is this coming from some kind of, you know, memory from childhood or teenage years? Did you have any toys that you played, you know, when you were younger that have inspired this?
It's funny. So when I was a kid, I played a ton of games, But the ones that just stuck in my brain were the Milton Bradley Game Master series, which would be games like Axis and Allies.
Ah, yeah.
Broadsides and Boarding Parties, Fortress America. So basically kind of Euro trashy games, but with tons of like plastic and toy factor in them. I don't know. Just as a kid, I just loved that sort of combination of the tactile toy-like units and then, you know, a game system underneath so that you could actually, instead of just pretending with your toys, you could actually have them fight it out, have a battle with them. So I don't know. Those games are like kind of have a special place in my memory.
I will say when I looked at it, it just made me think about playing Lego as a kid and the mechanical Lego and just trying to fiddle with little bits and see how it would work together. So it definitely evokes a sort of nostalgia for people.
Yeah, I think so. And I think we're shorthand often compared to Legos, but I think we're different in that, you know, Legos have now developed into being, I mean, Legos are awesome, but they're also very complicated models now. Wow. Like big sets with thousands of pieces and little parts and everything. And what we're trying to do with Snapships is give you, I guess, chunkier pieces. All of them are kind of bespoke or modeled, like they're a thing, right? They're an engine or a vent or a weapon or a wing, and those chunks just go together more quickly so that you can actually, you know, the hope is build something that looks really cool quickly and then change it around and try to mount the cockpit a different way and put more engines on or more wings on or whatever, but be creative and basically experiment and build something that, you know, when you're done with it, it doesn't look like a bunch of blocks smashed together. It actually looks like a miniature that might have been, you know, a one-shot mold in any other game.
Yeah, for sure. So what do you think is going to be the future of this series? And do you have any other plans now that you've sort of started getting into this, you know, more the tabletop side of things? You know, do you have plans to expand to more areas, or is, you know, miniature gaming your thing and you're going to be doing more in this space?
We're going to be just pushing forward with Snapships for the foreseeable future. I mean, the toy line itself, and I think this didn't go worldwide, but in the United States had 22 different kits.
Okay.
That we released. And so six of those kits kind of work within the game system, our new game system. So there's a lot of runway there of some really awesome kits and parts and all kinds of unique stuff that's kind of waiting to be brought into the game system to make the game kind of bigger and deeper and have more options. So that's kind of what the short-term plan looks like, is to try to bring more of that stuff in and get a bigger card pool, a bigger parts pool for people to work with. And then, you know, the lead designer of our game, one of the things he had become an expert in is building campaign systems and AI systems and things like that. So, you know, that getting Snapships to market is like a big, big undertaking. And we just, like I said, we just got the foundation in place. But now that that's done, there's some pretty obvious places to go in terms of like more campaign and co-op play and more story and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that was going to be one of my questions as well, is do you envision kind of injecting story, role-playing, campaign narrative elements into the Snapship Tactics system, and kind of what do you think that would look like?
Oh, for sure. And like I said, Josh, the lead designer, he developed an entire campaign system for X-Wing many years ago called Heroes of the Aturi Cluster, which I'm sure a lot of folks have played. And then more recently, he's done entire campaign systems for the Star Trek Alliance game. So, you know, Snapships is a perfect fit for that, because you can imagine a whole series of campaign-like missions with different objectives. We have an AI system already built into the game, so you can play against AI opponents. You could play against boss ships. You could, you know, and of course, the modularity of Snapships means that as you go through a campaign, of course, you know, you're going to get new parts, you're going to get new ships. I mean, it's just perfectly built to be a system where you're, you know, building up your capabilities in your ships and adding new parts as you go. So that's all kind of into the in the future. It's not something we have worked on yet, but it's a pretty obvious place that we'd like to go at some point.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I think, you know, that will expand the target audience for this type of game as well. I think there's a lot of people that would love to play something like this as a campaign game, either with other people or against an AI. And it was very good on my part to see that there's an included AI system in the game that works well. So I think there's going to be a lot of success with this game in the future. Now, we had a question from our Patreon supporters. This is actually from Sarah, who's an ex-member of our team. And we've been discussing this between us and in the community for quite some time now. And let's just say I have opinions on this. But this is about converting video game IPs to the board game space or video game design approaches to the board game space. And, you know, how there are challenges there. And my usual line in this is that, does this really need to be a board game? Should it have just been a video game? Is it too big? Is it too complex? Is it trying to replicate video game things in a non-video game environment? And I've got a couple of examples, you know, with usually massive narrative-driven campaign games like, you know, Aeon Trespass, Odyssey, and a couple of others that I usually reference when I talk about this. I don't know if you have any thoughts about this on, you know, moving, porting a video game system or even an IP, an existing IP to the board game space. And we've had a few examples of these the last few years. And, you know, you're in a unique position where you've worked in both industries. And what do you think are the main challenges and how to approach these when you do something like that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I completely understand why it happens. Obviously, because video games, the IP and the subject matter has such a big reach. It's a thing that people know. Hmm. So it gets their attention. It can be so hard in the board game industry to just get people's attention for something new and different that, you know, doesn't fall into one of those categories. So I understand that part of it. And I also, to a certain extent, understand that, you know, when I was making video games, we pour so much into the video games and we have fans who love those games, but it is just a digital product, right? It's like something you play on your TV. So I think there is a certain segment of people who do want something physical that they can put on their shelf or get out of the box and look through that kind of shows that they love this or want to experience this IP that they're big fans of in a new and different way. Now, the tricky part, I think, is that if you're going to, you know, adapt a video game into a board game, well, you have to, I guess, have a reason for that board game existing other than it's just fan service for, you know, video game players who like the IP. And that just comes, I guess, down to game design and having a, you know, really sharp game designers who know how to take the essence of a video game IP and turn it into a compelling board game that, if you stripped away the IP, would still be compelling for those fans. Seems tough to do, but I don't know if it can be done. So I don't know. It's a tricky one for sure.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation. And I think we've seen a lot of these, especially bigger games lately. And I do myself question that from time to time, you know, is this just, you know, an expansion to a new medium by an IP that is, you know, loved and very popular, and they haven't really thought about the game aspect of it, or are they, you know, legitimately trying to break into the board game space? So it's definitely interesting. But do you think that where you are now with Snapships Tactics, you would stay there? You mentioned before that after Call of Duty, you're kind of done with the video game space.
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of we're committed to the physical space right now.
Yeah.
could I ever see going back to doing some digital stuff? I mean, I do think that the Snapships IP is, you know, suitable for video game stuff. There's a lot you could do with it in the in the digital world.
That's going the other way, right? From the physical.
It is going the other way. And it's honestly going the easier way, because when I was in the video game industry, we used to run into lots of people who were working in sort of physical toys and things, and they always wanted to jump to the digital side. And I used to think, like, why would you want to do that? You're making these cool physical objects that are can sit in, on people's shelves and they can pick up and all that. And now I totally get it, that it's so much harder to manufacture a physical thing, get that through the process, put it on ships, get it across the ocean to wherever it needs to go, get it distributed to people. You get to skip that whole phase when you're working in digital, because you just upload a new build to the servers and everybody downloads that and away you go. And the other thing you don't have to worry about is you don't have to figure out how many digital copies to print, which is a real challenge as a board game publisher, is trying to strike the balance between printing too few and printing too many. And you can really, really get in trouble on either side of that equation. Whereas in the digital world, if it's a hit, well, people just keep downloading and downloading and downloading, and off you go to the races. You'll never run out of stock. So I totally get it now.
Yeah, I think a lot of people talk about, when they consider the crossover from video games to the physical space, design constraints that video games, you know, on the back end control all of the physics and the rules, but on the table you have to kind of front load that, and people have to learn how to navigate that themselves, which can kind of make the transition difficult. But I think people probably don't often think about just the logistical side of things and the kind of risk involved in manufacturing and shipping out globally a physical product. I do like that the way Snapships works, the kind of physicality of it, almost strikes a balance in the middle, because it's intuitive how you build things and how you manipulate things. You don't need to teach someone, you know, where the ships and where the engines are going to go. It all will kind of click in an intuitive sense. So the physical part of the game kind of does what video games do in that back end of, you know, this is how you construct a ship. You know, if I think of Eclipse, Second Dawn, for example, you have to learn all the rules. If this part goes here, and if you overlay something here, then you have to change it for this. And these are how the strengths and stats work. But having a physical toy almost kind of does some of what a video game kind of would otherwise do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it also just, I don't know, it's just fun to have a toyetic experience, I think, too, on top of your board game. You know, a challenge for us, though, was we felt really good about the toyetic aspects of Snapships, like you're describing, but we did also want to have a really compelling game underneath that as well. So we worked really, really hard, in the same way we would on a video game, just iterating constantly on the core systems and trying to come up with something that was actually really solid, had a lot of depth, but also was approachable. Like, we, you know, you see these large toy ships on the tabletop. We want that to be an approachable game and not one that has, you know, a hard bound rule book with, you know, addendums on addendums to cover all the different, you know, components and everything like that. We wanted it to have that variability, but also be easy to play. And that once you understood sort of the basic language of how Snapships are created, you could just mix and match parts at will and kind of figure it out on the fly.
Yeah, absolutely.
For sure. We've spoken about this next thing with board game designers in the past, but I thought it would be really interesting to hear your take on this, given this is a different space. And this is all about, you know, design versus development. And in a game like this, in a game that has miniature wargaming involved, where does that, you know, where does that cycle break, or does it break, or is it still a continuous thing? Where does the design work stop and where does the development work begin? And, you know, is that two separate boxes that you kind of have to, you know, isolate, or is that influencing each other, I suppose?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, some of the Snapships components were already perfected. So that was a big leg up for us. So as we were, then we could basically, you know, focus all of our design and development efforts on the game systems and making sure those were solid. But we did develop some new pieces for the game. And so we had to kind of do those two things together. We had to both design the pieces, design the abilities for those pieces, and then go through several revisions on just the pieces themselves to make sure they connected and worked in a way that didn't break the building system of the toy, while also developing sort of the gameplay cards and components and actions that go with that stuff. We just did a ton with Snapships. You know, the game is big and takes time to build some ships and then get them to the table. So we did just a ton of digital playtesting. We set up the entire card pool, all the models and all the systems in a program called Vassal, which is like a 2D wargaming system. And the beauty, this is something that came from our lead designer, Josh Dirksen. He set it all up. And the beauty of that system was something that we had kind of done in video games, which is we could have a whole Discord full of trusted people playtesting our game, and they could log their plays and they could upload replays to myself and Josh to review. And we could watch them step by step as they played through that game, but kind of in a fast speed so that we could review hundreds and hundreds of games that were played of Tactics really quickly, which was incredibly useful and awesome. And I don't think we could have sort of debugged the game without having access to that tool. It was really cool.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's a whole bunch of insights from you, Scott. Thank you so much. That was very useful. And I have had a ton of fun playing Snapships Tactics the last few days. And like you said, I think it's actually on display at PAX as of this week in here in Australia. Yeah, we'll keep going with the show. Next up, we have our sizzling games. So in this section, we pick a game that we've played recently or we've been impressed with lately, and we kind of pull it apart and present it. So Scott, would you like to join us in this?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do it.
What game would you like to talk about?
I think I would like to talk about Mindbug, which has been a bit of an addiction of mine ever since I discovered it on Kickstarter.
So yeah, tell us about it. How does Mindbug play for the people that aren't familiar with it?
So Mindbug is a deliciously simple game on its surface. It's a deck of cards. I would say they kind of pitch it as sort of Magic the Gathering boiled down to a single deck that you could just break out, deal to each player, and then you play a little duel back and forth with the cards that you're dealt. Mm-hmm. And every card that you play to the battlefield usually has some kind of interesting effect that affects the other cards on the battlefield. And you're basically, you only have 3 life points, and you're kind of playing a duel back and forth, trying to take your opponent down to 0 life points. But the card, the whole card set itself is just very cleverly designed, and it looks very simple on its surface, but there's a lot of mind games and interesting card play that comes out of this little set of cards. I recently heard or read somewhere that Magic the Gathering pro players, when they were at tournaments, were breaking out Mindbug in between rounds to challenge each other and to kind of a quick duel to when they were waiting for their next match to start. And that just makes perfect sense to me.
There's something special about, you know, these games that give you an interesting experience with a small, you know, portion of components or with a deck of cards. With, you know, I recently played Sprawlopolis, and, you know, I was impressed by how much game there was in that 18 card deck.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, I have a high appreciation of designs that get you a lot of game, a lot of interesting decision making with, you know, like you said, a deck of cards.
I would say that is all, in some ways, one of my favorite genres is the small portable game that when you go on vacation, you can pack up like five of these games that are small in volume, but pack a lot of really interesting gameplay and decisions in them. I love that genre of small card games like that. So Mindbug is like at the top of my current list for stuff that's going to go in the duffel bag.
That's awesome. I love that they just kind of stretch designers a bit more creatively as to how much you can do with so few components. It's easy to add things to a game. It's much harder to take things away.
Absolutely.
For me, Food Chain Island every day of the week is my go-to kind of little wallet game. It just has the crunchiest, most awful decisions in 18 cards.
I love that. Yeah, tightly designed games like that, I feel like are just, I don't know, there's something special about them. I even go back to like Hive as being like an old school, really tight game with very few pieces that always develops into an interesting little duel with just those simple components. Really cool.
But this is a game that you can easily teach to kids as well, right, Scott? Like Mindbug seems, from what I'm hearing from you, is that it's a game that you can play both as seasoned gamers and still have a lot of fun, but also for new people that come into the hobby and even younger kids to get their feet wet in something like this.
Absolutely. And I've actually done that. I discovered Mindbug on Kickstarter, backed it, and when it delivered, I played with my college age son, and we just played just tons of games, just over and over and over again. We really enjoyed the game. He grew up playing a little bit of Magic the Gathering with me as well. So it was like a nice way to scratch that itch without the whole time commitment of jumping back into Magic, which is super complicated now. But we've taken it on trips, and I've played it with my nephews and nieces, and you know, they're 10 years old, and they get just as sucked into the core gameplay of that game as well, and have a lot of fun trying to learn the whole system. So yeah, I think it is a great game that can kind of work for lots of different age groups.
I see on Board Game Geek that there's also different versions of the game, or maybe upcoming games that are in the plan. So it sounds like they're expanding these series of games.
Yeah, they did. So they ran a Kickstarter for the first set and delivered that. That's what I have. And then they've kickstarted a new sort of expansion set of cards, which I think you can play standalone or mix and match with the stuff that you already have. Not 100% certain on that. And then they've just recently made a digital client for the original Mindbug.
Oh.
And they're running, you can play the game digitally as well. So that's kind of a cool achievement. I know, coming from the video game world and the app world, it's not easy or cheap to build an online game, even if it's a simple card game. So props to them for getting that up and going. It's awesome.
Very good. So that is Mindbug. Thank you for that, Scott. Lauren, what have you got for us?
Oh, gosh. I've got a few things that I've been playing recently. I played Come Sail Away, which is the new game from Sashi and Sashi. It's their first big box game, actually. But you say big box game for Sashi and Sashi, it's all relative. I think what I love about their designs is that they're just always a bit different. They're never quite like any other games from any other publisher that I play. Even if I don't love the game, I'm always intrigued by the game. In Sashi and Sashi, as Come Sail Away, you're basically just putting passengers on a little kind of Titanic-esque boat using a Mancala-style system.
Oh.
So you'll pick up a card and it'll have a row of passengers. So say like green, blue, red, yellow. And you can start left to right or right to left, but you've got to place those workers around these kind of tiles on your ship in that order. So you can start from the left or start from the right, and you're going to be filling up different rooms that will have different requirements for the colors of workers they can take. And sometimes you'll get extra bonuses for the kinds of orders you place them in. But as you fill out your ship and you cover those, you're going to be covering these rooms and you're going to be much more constrained with where you can start that Mancala kind of little drip of workers and place them. So it becomes a kind of tighter and tighter and tighter puzzle of just optimizing how you place these workers and in which order. And it was really intriguing. It plays literally in 20 minutes. It is such a quick little game and quite quick to set up, but it's the first, I guess, expansion on, you know, what Sashi and Sashi are doing with their titles. And I thought it was really interesting. I own a lot of their games. I'm always happy to play them. I'm always very charmed by the theme and the art. This one, I think, is the same. I think it's his wife, actually, who does the art. They're the Sashi and Sashi. I think it's a husband and wife combo. And yeah, so a really interesting spatial puzzle. It's very multiplayer solitaire. You know, sure. Same playing it solo versus playing it with someone else. You are racing for some objectives, but I think I would just be happy to play this one solo or just set up for a chill time with a few people. But a very kind of interesting, increasingly tight spatial puzzle that did give me interesting decisions for the full 20 minutes. It didn't run longer than I wanted it to. And it was so quick to set up that even though it's a bigger box, I feel like I would happily pull this out on a night where I kind of don't really have the energy to pay too much more. It kind of fits the same niche that Button Shies and things do for me when I just want something a little simple, a little thinky. So I very much enjoyed Come Sail Away. It's actually being sold at Essen. I think Sashi and Sashi have a booth there, so people are getting their hands on it now. But yeah, Come Sail Away. Great, great little game.
That shipboard is amazing. It's beautiful to look at.
it's so charming, right? It's it's the sweetest designs.
Looking at the pictures, I agree with you, Scott. It looks very pretty. Is this ship configured like you have a bunch of rooms that you lay out in a different configuration every time?
Yeah. So there's five kind of core rooms and then five that are from a set from a whole different stack, and they'll be randomly arranged. And then once someone randomly arranges that, everyone will just, if you're playing with multiple people, will set up there so it's exactly the same. So it'll look a bit different every time. It's not a solvable puzzle in that respect.
Yeah, that's great because that changes the experience every time.
Is everyone playing to the same shipboard, or does each person have their own ship that they're filling?
Everyone's got their own ship in front of them that will look exactly the same. In the multiplayer game, you'll pick a card. You'll have a few of those passenger cards to choose from and kind of pick and pass along. But in the solo, you just pick from one of two and discard the other. But
got it.
Yeah, just a nice little game. Like, absolutely great. I've also been playing a lot of Nirashima Hex.
Oh, here we go.
Which is such a good game. Have you played it, Scott?
I have played it digitally, I think, actually. If I remember correctly, but not in a long, long time, right? Like the game goes back a number of years, right?
Yeah. So they were at Nirashima Hex 3. So certainly several iterations. The core system is great. It's continually being refined and certainly expanded upon. There's lots and lots of expansion factions, but in Nirashima Hex, you just have a kind of a grid arena of different hexagonal spaces. And a bit kind of like War Chest, you're going to be drawing out units or action tiles from a bag, and you'll have a selection of three. And from your three, you'll always need to play one and discard one. And so you're going to be placing out units on this kind of hexagonal tactical arena and deciding how you rotate them. The units will have either melee attacks, ranged attacks, or other effects that can do things like throwing nets on your opponent that will, you know, prevent them from attacking or push or move, things like that. But the interesting part about Nirashima Hex is that the different actions will trigger in certain priority orders. So initially you're just placing your units on this kind of arena that will fill up quite quickly because the units don't really move too much. And I mentioned as well that in addition to the kind of unit tiles, there are also action tiles, and one of those is a battle. And so you can use a battle token to trigger a battle. And what that's going to do is, in sequence, all of the units are going to attack in priority order. But where it gets a bit funky is trying to imagine how the battle is going to play out, because the higher priority units might attack and kill some lower priority units, which means that they then won't take an action. Or it might do something like a higher priority unit will attack a lower priority unit who was throwing a net on a different unit that was preventing that from having an action. It's now no longer preventing that unit, so then that unit will take an action. So there's these kinds of weird domino effect battles that sometimes I can't even imagine. I just kind of have to watch play out. But it's really good. It's really excellent. The different factions feel very different, really kind of thematic and unique. The tactics are less with kind of how you maneuver the units and more about where you place them, because once they're down, they're pretty well going to stay. And so placement on the board and kind of area control in that respect are also very, very important. But it is, I think, a skirmish game that people who like strategy games, more kind of Euro games, will probably still enjoy because it's quite heady, it's quite thinky. And it's over pretty quick. You're basically just trying to damage the opponent's base or do a certain kind of number of hit points. I think it's 20 before your opponent, but after a set number of rounds, whoever has the most hit points will win if, you know, neither has been destroyed. It is, yeah, again, very kind of strategic. I think that because the battles are so big and so outlandish, kind of like Tigris and Euphrates-esque, you'll have a battle sequence and half the board will be wiped. So it's not so devastating if you lose units because it happens so often. So I think that even people who are maybe a bit more conflict averse in games will still enjoy it.
Is this the kind of game that is mostly meant for duels, like for one versus one, or you play it with more people, like more, and it's still, you know, chaotic fun, I call it?
So the game goes 2 to 4. I've only played it at 2-player though. Okay. I've heard it's very good at 3-player, and then at 4 becomes very chaotic, which I guess could still be fun.
Yeah, for sure.
Can I throw out a video game pick?
Ooh, please. Yes.
Have you played Into the Breach?
No, I have not. My partner almost certainly has, but I have not. What is Into the Breach?
So it what you were talking about in Hiroshima Hex made me think of Into the Breach. Into the Breach is a strategy video game that plays very much like a board game. And in it, you have units that drop onto the board, and it's all about sequencing your units to eliminate the monster units that are on the board in the most efficient way possible. So it's almost like each board is almost like, again, similar to Hiroshima Hex, it's like a chessboard with combat and tactics, but you really have to think about the powers of each unit and sequencing each unit in the right
order. Oh, hang on. I've played this.
To solve the puzzle.
I've played this. Yeah. It's on mobile devices as well, isn't it? Like,
it is now. Yeah. Yeah. It came out on, I think, PC first. And it's the team that created it also created FTL, if you've ever played that strategy. But that's a genre I love, which is strategy digital games, and Into the Breach is one of the best. FTL as well. Both games are just phenomenal designs.
These are, wouldn't you say, Scott, that these are both video games that could be translated to the board game medium?
Mm-hmm. Oh, could be translated?
Into the Breach? With different scenarios in every level, is a different setup and different scenario, and I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you might end up with something closer to Hiroshima Hex, though. Yeah, I mean, true. One of the things that Into the Breach does, which is so clever, is it uses the video gamey medium to it basically. So you have your units, your team of three units, and then there'll be like four enemy units on the board. But every round, you can see exactly what the enemy units are going to do when they take their turn. So like an enemy unit might say it's going to charge forward and smash into one of your units. But then what you do is you take your actions to modify and change the state of the game so that when the enemy takes his action, it doesn't have any effect. So you might actually, that enemy unit's going to charge into your unit and smash you. Well, you move one of your units to push that enemy over one space. So now he's going to run into a mountain and damage himself or whatever, or run into lava. So like it's a really clever a clever game that, you know, you don't have to do all the math and the AI yourself. Yeah. You don't have to run it. The game runs it for you. So you can just focus on making the interesting decisions about what you're going to do.
Well, there you go then. Nuroshima Hex and Into the Breach. We're breaching out into the video game space now.
I'm looking at it now. It looks a bit like Final Fantasy Tactics, a little bit.
There are some elements of that, yeah, for sure. But it's almost like a thinky chessy puzzle too, which I'm guessing that Nuroshima Hex at some points gets into board states that feel very sort of thinky and chess-like in terms of what you need to do.
Absolutely.
Well, this is the place where I would, if I had a gavel, I would hit the gavel and say, I'm bringing everybody back to order now, back to board games.
If you're looking for a new board game, you need to check out adventgames.com.au. They have a great range of games, including pre-orders and hot new games. Anything you could be looking for will be there at Advent. Dean provides excellent customer service that is second to none, and he's always keen to support the Australian board game community through events, game days, and even through sponsoring a podcast. So head over to adventgames.com.au today. That's adventgames.com.au.
Very good. Well, I am going to talk about a game that I played recently a few times, and this game I was very keen to buy it when it first came out, just because of the theme. And then I saw some gameplay and it seemed okay, but it didn't blow me away. I still couldn't resist buying it because of the theme, and I'm glad I did because the game is actually very good. This is Lacrimosa. So this is published by Devue Games that gave us a couple of heavy games the last couple of years, a couple of heavy years, including Bitoku last year or the year before that. And yeah, so Lacrimosa is a midweight Euro game where you basically take the roles of patrons of Mozart who have just passed away, and basically you're trying to contribute to Mozart's works one last time. And the whole premise of the game is structured around Lacrimosa, which is a part of music, that a piece of music that Mozart presumably wrote the last notes on his deathbed and left unfinished. It's a popular piece of classical music. If you listen to it, I'm sure you'll recognize it. But because I grew up having a 20-year musical journey, classic musical journey, I was very, very keen to play this game. I was so excited to see that there's wooden pieces that have little notes on them that you sort of place on pentagram and try to contribute to that. But the game has a very clever action selection mechanic. So you start with a deck of 9 cards, and these cards have double use. You have this player board that you can, on your turn, play a card on the top and another card at the bottom. The cards at the top denote what action you'll be taking that turn. And the card you play at the bottom shows some resources that you'll be getting at the end of the round. And these are different Mozart points, story points, and travel points or something else. Or there's 3 different types of things that you use in the game to do different things. One of the things you do in the game is you have this Mozart token on the map of Central Europe, and you move it around, traveling in different parts of Europe, and you're taking actions or trying to acquire these tiles that get you end game scoring. There's an element of deck building in the game as well, because another action that you do is there's this market of cards that you can buy, and you add to your, well, essentially your discard pile. You replace cards that you've played that get you stronger abilities or get you more resources when you use them. They also score you points. But there's also this combination of actions at the bottom of the board where you have this pentagram and we have these instruments and different parts, different movements of a music piece at the bottom of Lacrimosa. And so you have like five different movements, and each movement has a combination of different instruments. And the way the game works there is, oddly enough, area control-y, where you have two composers that the players kind of support financially is the whole idea. And then you use the tiles that you take from these composers to place one of your own tokens that has a music note on it, either an eighth or a 16th, on that pentagram and covers one of the instruments. And which side you're going to place it on matters greatly, because at the end of the game, the composer that has the most sides facing up, so one of the composers is placed on the eighth note row and the other one is placed on the 16th note. So depending on which composer's tile you take, you place your token on that side on the pentagram. And so at the end of the game, each token belonging to the players with these notes up on these movements scores points based on its relative position in that area control element. So if there's, you know, three notes that have the 16th note facing up and two tokens that have the eighth note facing up, then that means the 16th note composer has the majority, I suppose, if you want to call it that. And then they score, you know, 4 points each, and the other one score 2 points each. And so you're trying to constantly balance this act of learning these, I guess, different pieces of music by buying the cards, and then you either promote them or you perform them, or you can even sell them to get points and things. But at the same time, you're trying to play this area control game at the bottom of the board with these gorgeous wooden pieces and placing these tokens either on the 8th or the 16th note side. I think the game is very thematic for a Euro game. It helps that I always play listening to Mozart, but I don't know if everybody will want to do that. The game is relatively quickly, but there is quite a bit of decision space in it. There's decisions that you have to make when you take the actions, but also decisions that you have to make when you place the cards at the bottom of your board to gain resources, because at the end of each round, any running resources that you have get depleted. They go back down to zero, and you only keep these round discs that give you almost like a permanent or, you know, persistent resource from round to round that you can still spend. And so you're planning for the next round as much as you're acting on the current round, which I find an interesting way of, you know, making the decision space a bit bigger. There's five rounds in the game, and in each round you also have like almost like an end of round scoring tile that lets you know at the start of the round what you're going to get at the end of it, depending on how you've done. I mean, apart from the, you know, the area control, the air majority element there at the bottom of the board, this is, again, you know, like almost like a multiplayer solitaire Euro game. There's quite a bit of competition for these cards that exist in the market, but the game is not very highly interactive, which is what you'd expect from a Euro game. But yeah, I've had a lot of fun playing this. I haven't tried the solo mode. Apparently its solo mode works well. I haven't tried that. I've played it multiplayer a few times, and yeah, I'm very, very happy that I got it. The theme is great, the board is gorgeous, and the idea of, you know, placing notes as wooden tokens is nothing I would have thought of, but very satisfying nevertheless.
It looks beautiful, looking at pictures of it now. As someone deaf who plays a musical instrument and maybe has a bit more working knowledge of kind of music in general, how do you find the thematic integration into the rules? Are they kind of nods?
Some of them, well, it's a Euro game. Most of them are nods, but there are...
That's okay.
Yeah. But I think, you know, I really loved the bit where you get involved with the actual movement composition and where you place the notes on the different movements of the piece of music. I think that bit is better or more thematically integrated than the rest of it. Some of the cards that you play allow you to perform or sell a piece of music that you've learned before. And that bit is very well integrated in the sense that what you're trying to do is you're trying to basically help these composers or motivate or finance these composers to help Mozart, you know, to help finish the work that Mozart left, have finished essentially. And from that perspective, you know, I also connect with it. Yeah, I think that everybody or anybody that has, you know, a connection to classical music would enjoy playing this. It's not a super heavy game. The rule set is not that difficult. You know, it's, call it like almost like a slightly heavier than something like Everdell in terms of a rule set, something like that. And it has 5 rounds. I would say probably, you know, 20 minutes, 15, 20 minutes per round. So maybe an hour and a half game, something like that, even maybe a bit quicker. If you're playing only with 2 players, I'd say it's probably down to an hour and 15, an hour and 20 minutes for a game of this. Yeah, I've been really enjoying it. And it makes me wonder how many themes have not been explored in this space, you know, because you would think that a theme like this, surely there's heaps of games around it. And yet, this is the first one that I remember getting drawn to. And I guess we're now at a age where board games, you know, through their production and the art and all the logistics that surround them, that they can support with their commercial success, they can become more appealing to people. So yeah, it would be great to see more games around this theme. I've been really enjoying it. So it's Lacrimosa. Have either of you played this?
I have not, but I'm looking at pictures, and it is the little. I guess it's the movements at the bottom of the board that look like sheet music, where all the notes and the area control battle goes on. That looks awesome. And I want to know if you can actually play the score that you create there. That's what I want to hear.
Well, there you go. That's an idea. We make an app that kind of scans the score sheet at the bottom and plays it out and see what you come up with.
You know, I think they've actually used AI to finish some of Mozart's works that he didn't finish before he passed away. So it's, yeah. Very, like, just a very interesting theme, very interesting part of history.
Yeah, and especially if you think about how much of his music has infiltrated pop culture, either through movies or, and people don't even realize, they don't, you know, people don't know necessarily who wrote that piece of music, but yeah, a lot of Mozart's work.
They've heard it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Has been, mm-hmm. You know, part of the pop culture for quite some time through some, or a lot of movies. So, yeah, so that is Lacrimosa by Devir Games. So, very happy with that. So, that was our sizzling games. Thank you for discussing these. A couple of announcements and news before we move on. Mentioned earlier that about Snapship's Tactics being at PAX, and we know that because PAX is actually happening as we record this episode. Some members of the Board Game Barbecue team are at PAX this past week, and so they've been doing interviews and recording down there throughout the conference or the convention, and so we will be releasing a special midweek episode from PAX. Look out for it before next week's episode. Not sure exactly when that's going to be, but it's going to be during the week. The other thing to mention is the Melbourne Game Day is coming up on November the 4th. The tickets are on Eventbrite now. So if you want to be in that Board Game Day, please go ahead and grab your ticket. There's going to be scheduled teachers that will go up as usual a few days before the game day that you can book in. And then after that, we've got the Brisbane Game Day on, as Adrian likes to call it, New Year's Eve, on December the 30th, which is going to go up until 2 a.m. for those that are braver than me. And yeah, lots of game days coming up. So grab your tickets while it's time. Question of the pod is the next section. And I mean, I have to say, I read some really interesting responses on this question from last week, which was, what small part of this hobby gives you great satisfaction? It was a two-edged sword, I have to say, this question. There were some very cool responses. Lawrence, you want to take us through some of the responses we got in the various social media?
Yeah, sure. So there's some people that spoke about kind of really little things, like you said, Def. Things maybe a bit more profound. So we've got Stephen Ellis says, building inserts from scratch for games I own.
That's pretty cool.
Gareth Menny says, clicking the own checkbox on Board Game Geek.
Okay.
And Evan Turner says, introducing a game to a friend and they love it. That feeling's pretty awesome. I do agree with
that. Yeah.
It's like when you watch a movie, you introduce a movie that you love to someone and you just, the whole time you're not watching the movie, you're watching their reaction to your favorite movie. It's like that.
Yeah,
right?
It is.
Kiara Moon says, picking and placing wooden bits like cubes, meeples or houses, rolling and or placing dice and building a tableau, which is a plus if the card art is beautiful. And Chris Shank says, I enjoy browsing my game shelves. It's not because I forget what I have. It's because I enjoy remembering. I see times with family members long gone. I see long nights of laughter with friends around a table. I see cherished memories that will stay with me forever.
Well, that's lovely.
It's quite lovely.
Yes.
Did you want to read some of the other stuff?
Yeah. Sylvain Malou says, first time opening a beautiful board. I can relate to that. Westlandia said, reaching into a bag to reveal a token tile. The suspense. I don't know if people that play Arkham Horror would agree with that, but we'll accept it. And Melanie Barr says, I really enjoy my group chats. Every day we reach out to each other in some way about board games. And I want to sit on this one for a minute because last year I took a bit of a sabbatical from the podcast and I left for a few months. And when I came back, I discovered that I missed more interacting with everyone. I was still part of the community and talking to everyone, but being really part of, you know, this hobby and being able to have discussions with other people about it is, I think, something else. I think it is very valuable and it is something that should not be underestimated. The hobby is a very welcoming space and we're lucky to be able to contribute to it.
Wholeheartedly agree, Def. I think that there, you know, lots of answers like shuffling sleeve cards and using up exactly all your resources correctly.
Sniffing the cardboard.
But there's a lot of, yeah, small interactions with people you love constantly in games that just make it, yeah, a wonderful hobby.
Well, the new question of the pod for this week, coming from the discussion we had with Scott earlier, is going to be which game you wish you had when you were younger. Scott, Snapship's Tactics as a response is not allowed from you. So which game you wish existed or you wish you had when you were younger? Like the reason for this is because the game that you created or you developed, Snapship's Tactics, was the response in a couple of these comments in our Discord community this last couple of weeks. Somebody brought it up and somebody else said, oh, you know, I wish I had this when I was 15 because of, you know, the whole experience it would give a person that age. Does something jump out in terms of, oh, I wish I had this when I was younger?
Oh, man, that's a tough one. I maybe might just mention one of my all-time favorite games, which is Memoir 44.
Oh, yes, please.
That whole system is just brilliant and, you know, kind of toyetic in a way. Like there's lots of plastic bits that are fun to deploy to the board. And it's just a really nice system with almost infinite replayability because there's so many scenarios and even like fan-made scenarios and things. You can just keep going deeper and deeper with that game. I love that game.
Yeah, for sure. I can totally see that. And even the little plastic soldiers and the, I guess the form of those miniatures, the old school type form, does give me memories from childhood and you know, things that existed back then. Lauren, do you have something that you wish existed when you were younger?
Oh, definitely. I will say, Scott, on the Memoir 44, I do feel like in high school, the Overlord Memoir 44 experience with, is that the one where you have, you know, 4-8 aside?
Yeah, the big, yeah. The bigger.
The big, oh, yeah.
I think I would have loved that. mine is probably Blood on the Clock Tower. The reason being, because when I was in high school, I played a lot of Werewolf and a lot of Social Deduction. And while I don't play that as much anymore, I think that my group of friends that got together would have just dove headfirst into kind of a meatier social deduction system. Because I think when you're younger, you have more time. So I think it's going to be games that you just have the time and freedom to play. But also, there were more times that I was getting together with 10, 15, 20 friends that I don't really do that anymore. But I certainly had a lot of experiences doing that back then. So I kind of wish I had these big, mega, ultra game experiences at my disposal that I could have, yeah, played back then. What about you, Def? Anything come to mind?
Not specifically. I think for me, one of the things that I have seen lately that I said, oh, this would have been amazing if we had access to stuff like that when we were younger, is more the games that have a certain tactile aspect to them on the table. The games I'm thinking here is the chip theory games like Too Many Bones and Burn Cycle. And I think, you know, I don't know why specifically those, but that's kind of a reaction I get sometimes when I play these, that these would have been amazing to have existed 20, 25 years ago.
Yeah, awesome.
But those are just our opinions. We want to hear the opinions from you, our community. We will post the question as soon as the episode airs, and please give us your responses on our different social media. And yeah, we're going to move on to Swearing an Oath. But before we do that, I just want to do a quick shout out to our Patreon supporters. I'll mention four off the top of the list here: Oliver Millen, Pez, Shoitan, my good friend Adnan, Stacey Robinson. Thank you so much for your support. It means a lot to us. If you want to support the podcast, you can always go to patreon.com/sportgamebarbecue. We get regular podcast episodes exclusive to Patreon supporters. Lauren and I just recorded one only a few days ago, which was great fun. But if you don't want to donate that way, you can always support us in a different way. You can leave a review or a star rating for us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify's new star rating system. These always help us a lot because they expose the podcast to more people. And of course, you can always get involved in our Board Game Barbecue community on Facebook group or on our social media. And you can always find us on our Discord playing games and having conversations there. But thank you very much for your support. And now to Swearing an Oath. So, Scott, I kind of briefed you on this before we started the recording about this insanity that we've had since we started the podcast, where we kind of try to swear an oath about either to play a game off of our self of shame or teach random people games on airplanes, as more recent episodes have shown. So we would love you to, if you could participate in this. I might actually kick us off with this one because I had a couple of oaths outstanding. One was pending from two episodes ago, which was to play Bus, which was gifted to me for my birthday a couple of weeks ago from my game group, which was fantastic. Very, very lovely of them. And the other one was to play Lacrimosa. I've played both of these games. Lacrimosa I've spoken about today. Bus, we had a great time. It's such a such a clever and interactive game and so much space to be an absolute, I'm trying not to use a swear word here, to other people, but because it plays quickly, you kind of don't mind it. And if you have the right group for it, it can be great fun. And so I've managed to fulfill my oaths. As far as a new oath is concerned, Lauren, you thought that this game is a good oath. Should I go with it?
Oh, definitely. I want to hear about it, so I really want you to play.
So this was a spontaneous purchase last week. This is Zoo Tycoon, a new heavy euro about building a zoo. So it looks very pretty, looks very involved, which is how I like the games. So, that will be my new oath. By the next time I'm on the podcast, I swear to play Zoo Tycoon. What about you, Lauren?
Well, I managed to fulfill Come Sail Away by the skin of my teeth. I played it this morning.
love the honesty, I have to say.
It is done. Played it twice, though, so got it done. I feel like if oaths are about getting games that we really need to get played off the shelf, then I probably need to finish my campaign of Pandemic Legacy Season 1 that I started in 2020. yeah.
So you started it in the middle of the pandemic and you haven't finished it yet.
Correct. It was quite a thematic experience. And so we got through 7 months of Pandemic Legacy Season 1, kind of fell off the wagon with it and then never got back. So hopefully by the next time I'm on the pod, I will have finished the second half of Pandemic Legacy Season 1.
Very good. That was one of the best board game experiences I've ever had, playing through that system for the first time. I have to say Season 2 and Season 0 afterwards felt a bit meh. Mm. They're okay. I've had enough of this. Can we get going? But I remember the first time going through Pandemic Legacy Season 1 was absolutely fantastic. So, Scott, would you like to participate in this craziness? I know, obviously, you probably won't be next week on the show with us, but maybe you can tell us of something you'd like to achieve and then let us know through social media or let us know next time you're on the show.
Absolutely. I'm going to give you two oaths.
Oh, here we go. I'm loving it.
I love it.
Diving in.
All right. So my first oath is I did this once a while ago, and I want to do it again, and that is to attend a local prototyping game group and play some prototypes by local designers and give them feedback.
Fantastic.
I know how useful that was for me when we were working on Snapships. And I want to encourage everyone out there to look for your local prototype group and see if you can help them out. And then my second oath is a game I've just heard about, and I don't even have a group I think this is appropriate for, so it's a good oath. I'm going to have to acquire this game, play it, find a group, and that is John Company.
Oh.
I don't know if you guys have covered that.
never played it.
Okay. So it's, from what I understand, it's a kind of dark and serious game covering serious subject matter and engaging with it, and I find that interesting to and it's by Cole Worley, so I want to make an oath to try to track that down and get at least one play of that in.
Def, how many times have you played this game now?
More than a few, so
I figured that would probably be the case.
Yeah, for those that want to listen to me blushing off about John Company, you can listen to episode 208. Yeah, I've played this game a lot. It landed and exploded like a bomb in my sort of board game hobby because it's not a game I would typically play. I don't like negotiation games. I don't like, games where players' personalities come into play more than the game mechanics. And yet, this has been an absolute revelation. We've played so much of this. I've even played it solo a few times. Yeah, it's provided some of the best board game experiences I've had, and it keeps doing that even after 25, 30 times I've played it now. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's a fantastic design, and Yeah, the love and care that's gone into this by Cole Worley is absolutely mind-blowing. So I think you cannot go wrong with it, but I would very much like to hear how you go with it and what you think once you've played it. So yeah, let us know.
Will do, for sure.
All right, and that brings us to the end of the show today. I want to thank Scott for being with us today. Scott, thank you very much for the discussion and your insights into the tabletop and board game industries. Before going, would you like to tell us where people can find you, website or something like that, if they want to get in touch with you?
Yeah, sure. It's pretty easy. Snapshipstactics.com is our kind of main hub, and there's all kinds of information about the game and links to our Discord and social media and all that. And Snapshipz Tactics is available now, and it's available through Meeple in Australia.
Fantastic. And thank you, Lauren, for joining today. It was a great discussion, and hopefully the listeners enjoyed as well.
Yeah, no, thanks so much as always for having me. That was great fun. Cheers again, Scott. That was awesome.
Thank you, everyone, and keep playing your games. See you next week. Cheers.
Bye.
That was fun. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.